surprisingly fast. By dusk that evening, Philip and Nick are connecting the last sections on the northern edge of the property line.
"I've been keeping an eye on him all day," Philip is saying, pressing the forked tip of the nail gun against the bracing of a corner section.
He's referring to the swarms out near the golf club. Nick nods as he butts the two support beams against each other. Philip pulls the trigger, and the nail gun makes a muffled snapping noise, like the crack of a metal whip, sending a 6-inch galvanized nail into the boards. The nail gun is baffled with a small piece of packing blanket, secured with duct tape to dampen the noise.
"I ain't seen a single one of them wander closer," Philip says,
wiping the sweat from his brow, moving to the next section of support beams. Nick holds the board steady, and the tip presses down.
Whoomp!
"I don't know," Nick says skeptically, moving to the next section, the sweat making his satin roadie jacket cling to his back.
"I still say it's not if, but when."
Whoomp!
"You worry too much, son," Philip says, moving to the next section of planking, tugging on the gun's cord.
The extension cable snakes off toward an outlet on the corner of the neighbor's house. Philip had to connect a grand total of 6 28-foot cords to get the thing to reach. He pauses and glances over his shoulder. About 50 yards away, in the backyard of the Colonial, Brian pushes Penny in a swing. It's taken a little getting used to for Philip, putting his hapless brother in charge of his precious little girl. But right now, Brian's the best nanny he's got. The playset, of course, is deluxe. Rich folks love to spoil their kids with shit like this. This one, more than likely a haunt of the missing kid, has got all the bells and whistles. Slide, clubhouse, 4 swings, climbing wall, jungle gym, and sandbox. "We got a maid here," Philip goes on, turning back to his work. "Long as we keep our heads screwed on straight, we're gonna be fine." As they position the next section, the rustling sounds of their movements and the creak of the planks mask the telltale noise of shuffling footsteps. The footsteps are coming from across the street. Philip doesn't hear them until the errant zombie is close enough for its odor to register. Nick is the first one to smell it. That black, oily, mildewy combination of rotting protein and decay, like human waste cooking in bacon grease. It immediately puts Nick's guard up.
"Wait a minute," he says, holding a section of planking. "You smell?"
"Yeah." "Smells like..." A fishbelly arm bursts through a gap in the fencing, grabbing a hank of Philip's denim shirt. The assailant was once a middle-aged woman in a designer running suit, now an emaciated wraith with torn sleeves, blackened, exposed teeth, and the button eyes of a prehistoric fish, her hooked hand clutching Philip's shirt tail with the vice grip of frozen dead fingers. She lets out a low groan like a broken pipe organ as Philip spins toward his axe, which lies canted against a wheelbarrow 20 feet away. Too damn far. The dead lady goes for Philip's neck with the autonomic hunger of a giant snapping turtle, and across the yard, Nick fumbles for a weapon, but it's all happening too fast. Philip rears backward with a grunt, just now realizing that he still holds the nail gun. He dodges the snapping teeth, and then instinctively raises the muzzle of the nail gun. In one quick movement, he touches the tip to the thing's brow. Phoomp! The lady zombie stiffens. Icy fingers release their grip on Philip. He pulls himself free, huffing and puffing, gaping at the thing. The vertical cadaver teeters for a moment, wobbling as if drunk, shuddering in its soiled velveteen Pierre Cardin warm-up, but it will not go down. The head of the 6-inch galvanized nail is visible above the ridge of the lady's nose like a tiny coin stuck there. The thing remains upright for endless moments, its shark-like eyes turned upward, until it begins to slowly stagger backward across the parkway, its ruined face taking on a strange, almost dreamy expression. For a moment, it looks as though the thing is remembering something, or hearing some high-pitched whistle. Then it collapses in the grass. "I think the nail does just enough damage to take him out,"
Philip is saying after dinner, pacing back and forth across the shuttered windows of the lavish dining room, the nail gun in his hand like a visual aid. The others are sitting at the long, burnished oak table, the remnants of dinner lying strewn in front of them. Brian cooked for the group that night, defrosting a roast in the microwave and making gravy with a vintage Cabernet and a splash of cream. Penny's in the adjacent family room watching a DVD of Dora the Explorer. "Yeah, but you see the way that thing went down?" Nick points out, pushing an uneaten gob of meat across his plate. "After you zapped it, looked like the damn thing was stone for a second." Philip keeps pacing, clicking the trigger of the nail gun and thinking. "Yeah, but it did go down." "It's quieter than a gun, I'll give you that. And it's a hell of a lot easier than splitting their skulls open with an axe." Bobby has just started in on a second helping of pot roast and gravy. "So bad you don't have a 6-mile extension cord," he says with his mouth full. Philip clicks the trigger a few more times. "Maybe we could hook this puppy up to a battery." Nick looks up. "Like a car battery?" "No, like something you could carry more easily, something like one of them big lantern batteries, something out of one of them electric mowers." Nick shrugs. Bobby eats. Philip paces and thinks. Brian stares at the wall, mumbling, "Something to do with their brains." "Say what?" Philip looks at his brother. "What was that, Bri?" Brian looks at him. "Those things. The sickness. It's basically in the brain, right? It's gotta be." He pauses. He looks at his plate. "I still say we don't even know they're dead." Nick looks at Brian. "You mean after we take him out? After we destroy him?" "No, I mean before," Brian says. "I mean, like the condition they're in." Philip stops pacing. "Shit, man. On Monday, I saw one of them get squashed by an 18-wheeler, and 10 minutes later, it's dragging itself along the street with its guts hanging out. They've been saying it on all the news reports. They're dead, sport. They're way dead." "I'm just saying. The central nervous system, man, is complicated. All the shit in the environment right now, new strains of shit. Hey, you want to take one of them things to a doctor for a checkup, be my guest." Brian sighs. "All I'm saying is, we don't know enough yet. We don't know shit. We know all we need to know," Philip says, giving his brother a look. "We know there's more of them fucking things every day, and all they seem to want to do is have us for lunch. Which is why we're gonna hang here for a while. Let things play out a little." Brian breathes out a painful, weary sigh. The others are silent. In the lull, they can hear the faint noises that they've been hearing all night, coming from the darkness outside. The muffled, intermittent thudding of insensate figures bumping up against the makeshift barricade. Despite Philip's efforts to erect the rampart quickly and quietly, the commotion of the day's construction project has drawn more of the walking corpses. "How long do you think we're going to be able to stay here?" Brian asks softly. Philip sits down, lays the nail gun on the table, and takes another sip of his bourbon. He nods toward the family room, where the whimsical voices of children's programming drift incongruously. "She needs a break," Philip says. "She's exhausted." "She loves that place at Outback," Brian says with a weak smile. Philip nods. "She can live a normal life here for a while." Everybody looks at him. Everybody silently chews on the concept. "Here's to all the rich motherfuckers of the world," Philip says, raising his glass. The others toast, without really knowing just exactly what they're toasting, or how long it will last. Chapter 4. The next day, in the clean autumn sun, Penny plays in the backyard under the watchful gaze of Brian. She plays throughout the morning while the others take inventory and sort through their supplies. In the afternoon, Philip and Nick secure the window wells in the basement with extra planking and try unsuccessfully to rig the nail gun to DC power, while Bobby, Brian, and Penny play cards in the family room. The proximity of the undead is a constant factor, swimming shark-like under the surface of every decision, every activity. But for the moment, there's just an occasional stray, an errant wanderer bumping up against the privacy fence, then shambling away. For the most part, the activity behind the 7-foot cedar bulwark on Greenbrier Lane has so far gone unnoticed by the swarm. That night after dinner, with the shades drawn, they all watch a Jim Carrey movie in the family room, and they almost feel normal again. They're all starting to get used to this place. The occasional muffled thump out in the darkness barely registers now. Brian has practically forgotten the missing 12-year-old, and after Penny goes to bed, the men make long-term plans. They discuss the implications of staying in the Colonial as long as supplies hold out. They've got enough provisions for weeks. Nick wonders if they should send out a scout, maybe gauge the situation on the roads into Atlanta, but Philip is adamant about staying put. "Let whoever's out there duke it out among themselves," Philip advises. Nick is still keeping tabs on the radio, TV, and internet, and like the failing bodily functions of a terminal patient, the media seems to be sparking out one organ at a time. By this point, most radio stations are playing either recorded programming or useless emergency information. TV networks, the ones on basic cable that are still up and running, are now resorting to either 24-hour automated civil defense announcements or inexplicable, incongruous reruns of banal late-night infomercials. By the third day, Nick realizes that most of the radio dial is static, most of basic cable is snow, and the Wi-Fi in the house is gone. No dial-up connections are working, and the regular phone calls Nick has been making to emergency numbers, which up to this point have all played back recordings, are now sending back the classic "fuck you" from the phone company. "The number you have dialed is not available at this time. Please try again later." By late morning that day, the sky clouds over. In the afternoon, a dismal, chill mist falls on the community, and everybody huddles indoors, trying to ignore the fact that there's a fine line between being safe and being a prisoner. Other than Nick, most of them are tired of talking about Atlanta. Atlanta seems farther away now, as if the more they ponder the 20-some miles between Wiltshire and the city, the more impassable they seem. That night, after everybody drifts off to sleep, Philip sits his lonely vigil in the living room next to a slumbering Penny. The mist has deteriorated into full-blown thunder and lightning. Philip pokes a finger between two shutter slats and he peers out into the darkness. Through the gap, he can see, over the top of the barricade, the winding side streets and massive shadows of live oaks, their branches bending in the wind. Lightning flickers. 200 yards away, a dozen or so humanoid shapes materialize in the strobe light, moving aimlessly through the rain. It's hard to tell for sure from Philip's vantage point, but it looks as though the things might be moving in their leaden, retarded fashion like stroke victims. This way. Do they smell fresh meat? Did the noises of human activity draw them out? Or are they simply lumbering around randomly like ghastly goldfish in a bowl? Right then, for the first time since they arrived at Wiltshire Estates, Philip Blake begins to wonder if their days in this womb of wall-to-wall carpet and overstuffed sofas are numbered. The fourth day dawns cold and overcast. The pewter-colored sky hangs low over the wet lawns and abandoned homes. Although the occasion goes unspoken, the new day marks a milestone of sorts. The beginning of the plague's second week. Now Philip stands with his coffee in the living room, peering out through the shutters at the jury-rigged barricade. In the pale morning light, he can see the northeast corner of the fence shuddering and trembling. "Son of a buck," he mutters under his breath. "What's the matter?" Brian's voice snaps Philip out of his stupor. "There's more of them." "Shit, how many?" "Can't tell," What do you want to do?
Bobby.
The big man trundles into the living room in his sweatpants and bare feet, eating a banana. Philip turns to his portly pal and says, "Get dressed." Bobby swallows a mouthful of banana.
What's going on?
Philip ignores the question, looks at Brian. Keep Penny in the family room.
Will do,
Brian says and hurries off. Philip starts toward the stairs, calling out as he goes.
Get the nail gun and as many extension cords as you can carry. Hatchets, too.
Phoomp! Number 5 goes down like a giant rag doll in tattered suit pants, the dead milky eyes rolling back in its head as it slides down the other side of the fence, its putrid body collapsing to the parkway. Philip steps back, breathing hard from the exertion, damp with sweat in his denim jacket and jeans. Numbers 1 through 4 had been as easy as shooting fish in a barrel. 1 female and 3 males, all of whom Philip had sneaked up on with the nail gun as they bumped and clawed against the weak spot at the fence's corner. At that point, all Philip had to do was stand on the bottom strut with a good angle on the tops of their heads. He put them down quickly, one after another. Foomp! 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 Foomp!
Number 5 had been slippery. Inadvertently jerking out of the line of fire at the last moment, it did a little intoxicated shuffle, then craned its neck upward at Philip, jaws snapping. Philip had to waste 2 nails, both of which ricocheted off the sidewalk before he finally sent one home into the suit-wearing asshole's cerebral cortex. Now Philip catches his breath, doubled over with exhaustion, the nail gun still in his right hand, still plugged into the house with 4 25-foot cords. He straightens up and listens. The front parkway is silent now. The fence is still. Glancing over his shoulder, Philip sees Bobby Marsh in the backyard about 100 feet away. The big man is sitting on his fat ass trying to catch his breath, leaning against a small abandoned doghouse. The doghouse has a little shingle roof, and the word Laddie Boy mounted above the opening at one end.
These rich people and their fucking dogs, Philip thinks ruefully, still a little manic and wired. Probably fed that thing better than most kids.
Over the back fence, about 20 feet away from Bobby, the limp remains of a dead woman are draped over the crest, a hatchet still buried in her skull where Bobby Marsh put out her lights. Philip gives Bobby a wave and a hard, questioning look.
Everything cool?
Bobby returns the gesture with a thumbs up. Then, almost without warning, things begin happening very quickly. The first indication that something is decidedly not cool occurs within a split second of Bobby signaling the thumbs-up sign to his friend and leader and mentor. Drenched in sweat, his heart still pumping with the burden of his huge girth as he sits leaning against the doghouse, Bobby manages to accompany the thumbs-up signal with a smile, completely oblivious to the muffled noise coming from inside the doghouse. For years now, Bobby Marsh has secretly yearned to please Philip Blake, and the prospect of giving Philip the thumbs up after a messy job well done fills Bobby with a weird kind of satisfaction. An only child, barely able to make it out of high school, Bobby clung to Philip in the years before Sarah Blake had died, and after that, after Philip had drifted away from his drinking buddies, Bobby had desperately tried to reconnect. Bobby called Philip too many times. Bobby talked too much when they were together. And Bobby often made a fool of himself trying to keep up with the wiry alpha dog of a ringleader. But now, in a strange way, Bobby feels as though this bizarre epidemic has, among other things, given Bobby a way to bond again with Philip. All of which is probably why, at first, Bobby doesn't hear the noise inside the doghouse. When the thump comes, as if a giant heart were beating inside the little miniature shack, Bobby's smile freezes on his face, and his upturned thumb falls to his side. And by the time the realization that there's something inside the doghouse, something moving, manages to travel the synapses of Bobby's brain and register plainly enough for him to move, it's already too late. Something small and low to the ground bursts out of the doghouse's arched opening. Philip is already halfway across the yard, running at a full sprint, when it becomes clear that the thing that has just thrust its way out of the doghouse is a tiny human being, or at least a rotting, bluish, contorted facsimile of a tiny human being, with leaves and dog shit in its filthy, matted blonde bangs, and chains tangled around its waist and legs.
Fuck!
Bobby yelps and jerks back away from the 12-year-old corpse as the thing that was once a boy now pounces on Bobby's ham-hock-sized leg. Bobby tumbles sideways, ripping his leg free in the nick of time, just as the little contorted face, like a sunken gourd with hollow cavities for eyes, gobbles the grass where Bobby's leg had been 1 millisecond earlier. Philip is now 50 feet away, charging toward the doghouse at top speed, raising the nail gun like a divining rod aimed at the miniature monster. Bobby crawls crab-like through the damp grass, his ass crack showing pathetically, his gasps high and shrill like those of a little girl. The pint-sized fiend moves with the graceless energy of a tarantula, scuttling across the grass toward Bobby. The fat man tries to struggle to his feet and run, but his legs get tangled and he tumbles again, backward this time. Philip is 20 feet away when Bobby starts shrieking in a higher register. The zombie child has hooked a claw-like hand around Bobby's ankle, and before Bobby can wrest his leg away from the thing, it sinks a mouthful of putrefying teeth into Bobby's leg.
God damn it!
Philip booms as he approaches with the nail gun. 100 feet behind him, the extension cord pulls free of the outlet. Philip slams the tip of the nail gun down on the back of the thing's skull as the monster latches on to Bobby's quivering fat body. The nail gun trigger clicks. Nothing happens. The zombie burrows down into Bobby's flaccid thigh, piranha-like, breaching his femoral artery and taking half his scrotum with it. Bobby's scream deteriorates into an ululating howl as Philip instinctively tosses the gun aside, then lurches at the beast. He tears the thing off his friend as though removing a giant leech and heaves it, head over heels, across the lawn before it has a chance to take another bite. The dead child flops and rolls 20 feet across the muddy grass. Nick and Brian burst out of the house, Brian grabbing for the extension cord, Nick roaring across the lawn with a pickaxe. Philip grabs Bobby and tries to stop him from squirming and screaming, because the extra exertion is making the big man hemorrhage faster, the ragged wound already sending up geysers of blood in rhythm with Bobby's quickening pulse. Philip slams his hand down on Bobby's leg, stenching the flow slightly, the blood oozing between Philip's greasy fingers as other figures move across Philip's peripheral vision. The dead thing is crawling back across the moist ground toward Philip and Bobby, and Nick doesn't hesitate, approaching in a sprint, raising the axe, eyes wide with panic and rage. The axe sings through the air, the rusty point coming down on the back of the zombie child's skull, sinking 3 inches into the cranial cavity. The monster deflates. Philip screams up at Nick something about a belt.
A belt!
And now Nick is hovering, fumbling for his belt. Philip has no formal training in first aid, but he knows enough to try and stop the bleeding with some kind of tourniquet. He wraps Nick's belt around the shivering fat man's leg, and Bobby is trying to talk again, but he looks like a man experiencing extreme cold, his lips moving, quivering silently. Meantime, as all this is going on, Brian is 100 feet away, plugging the extension cord back in the outlet, probably because it's all he can think of doing. The nail gun lies in the grass 15 feet behind Philip. At this point, Philip is shouting at Nick to
go get some fucking bandages and alcohol and whatever!
Nick hurries off, still carrying the pickaxe while Brian approaches, staring at the dead thing lying face down in the grass, its skull stoved in. Brian gives it a wide berth. He picks up the nail gun, just in case, and he scans the hill behind the back fence as Philip now holds Bobby in his arms like a giant baby. Bobby is crying, breathing quick, shallow, rattling breaths. Philip comforts his friend, murmuring encouragement and assuring him that it's all gonna be okay. But it's clear, as Brian cautiously approaches, that things are definitely not gonna be okay.
Moments later, Nick returns with an armful of large, sterile cotton bandages from inside, as well as a plastic bottle of alcohol in one back pocket and a roll of cotton tape in the other. But something has changed. The emergency is transformed into something darker. A death watch.
"We gotta get him inside,"
Philip announces, now soaked in his friend's blood. But Philip makes no effort to lift the fat man. Bobby Marsh is going to die. That much is clear to all of them. It's especially clear to Bobby Marsh, who now lies in a state of shock, staring up at the gunmetal sky, struggling to speak. Brian stands nearby, holding the nail gun at his side, staring down at Bobby. Nick drops the bandages. He lets out an anguished breath. He looks as though he might start to cry, but instead he simply drops to his knees on the other side of Bobby and hangs his head. Bobby Marsh tries desperately to get Philip to understand something.
Shh.
Philip strokes the man's shoulder. Philip can't think straight. He turns, grabs a roll of bandages, and starts dressing the wound.
No!
Bobby pushes the bandage away.
Bobby, goddammit! No!
Philip stops, swallowing hard, looks into the watery eyes of the dying man.
It's gonna be okay,
Philip says, his voice changing.
No, it ain't,
Bobby manages. Somewhere way up in the sky, a crow yammers. Bobby knows what's gonna happen. They saw a man in a ditch back in Covington come back in less than 10 minutes.
Stop saying that, Philly.
Bobby, it's over. Bobby manages in a feeble whisper, and his eyes roll back for a moment. Then he sees the nail gun in Brian's hand. With his big bloody sausage fingers, Bobby reaches for the muzzle. Brian drops the gun with a start.
God damn it, we gotta get him inside!
Philip's voice is laced with hopelessness as Bobby Marsh blindly reaches for the nail gun. He gets his fat hand around the pointed barrel and tries to lift it to his temple.
Jesus Christ,
Nick utters.
Get that thing away from him!
Philip waves Brian away from the victim. Bobby's tears track down the sides of his huge head, cleansing the blood in streaks.
Please, Philly,
Bobby murmurs.
Just do it.
Philip stands up.
Nick, come here.
Philip turns and walks a few paces toward the house. Nick rises to his feet and joins Philip. The two men stand 15 feet away from Bobby, out of earshot, their backs turned, their voices low and strained.
We gotta cut him,
Philip says quickly.
We got what?
Amputate his leg.
What?
Before the sickness spreads.
But how do you... We don't know how fast it spreads. We gotta try. We owe the man at least that.
But I'm gonna need you to get the hacksaw from the shed and also bring... A voice rings out behind them, interrupting Philip's tense litany.
Guys?
It's Brian. And from the grim sound of his nasally call, the news is most likely bad. Philip and Nick turn. Bobby Marsh is stone still. Brian's eyes well up as he kneels next to the fat man.
It's too late.
Philip and Nick come over to where Bobby lies in the grass, his eyes closed. His big, flabby chest doesn't move. His mouth is slack.
Oh, no. Sweet Jesus Christ, no,
Nick says, staring at his dead pal. Philip doesn't say anything for quite a long time. No one does. The immense corpse lies still, there on the wet ground for endless minutes, until something stirs in the man's extremities, in the tendons of his massive legs, and in the tips of his plump fingers. At first, the phenomenon looks like the typical residual nerve twitches that morticians might see now and again, the dieseling engine of a cadaver's central nervous system. But as Nick and Brian gape, their eyes widening, both of them slowly rising, then slowly beginning to back away. Philip comes closer still, kneeling down, a sullen businesslike expression on his face. Bobby Marsh's eyes open. The pupils have turned as white as pus. Philip grabs the nail gun and presses it to the big man's forehead just above the left eyebrow. Phoomp! Hours later, inside the house, after dark, Penny asleep, Nick in the kitchen, drowning his grief in whiskey. Brian nowhere to be found. Bobby's cooling corpse in the backyard, covered in a tarp next to the other bodies. And Philip now standing at the living room window, gazing out through the slatted shutters at the growing number of dark figures on the street. They shuffle like sleepwalkers, moving back and forth behind the barricade. There are more of them now. 30 maybe. 40 even. Streetlights shine through the cracks in the fence, the moving shadows breaking the beams at irregular intervals, making the light strobe, making Philip crazy. He hears the silent voice in his head, the same voice that first made itself known after Sarah had died. Burn the place down. Burn the whole fucking world down. For a moment earlier that day, after Bobby had died, the voice had wanted to mutilate the 12-year-old's body. The voice had wanted to take that dead thing apart. But Philip tamped it down, and now he's fighting it again. The fuse is lit, brother. The clock is ticking. Philip looks away from the window, and he rubs his tired eyes. It's okay to let it out, a different voice says now, coming from across the darkness. Philip whirls and sees the silhouette of his brother across the living room, standing in the archway of the kitchen. Turning back to the window, Philip offers no response. Brian comes over. He's holding a bottle of cough syrup in his trembling hands. In the darkness, his feverish eyes shimmer with tears. He stands there for a moment. Then he says in a low, soft voice, careful not to awaken Penny on the couch next to them, "There's no shame in letting it out." "Letting what out?" "Look," Brian says. "I know you're hurting." He sniffs, wipes his mouth on his sleeve, his voice hoarse and congested. "All I want to say is, I'm really sorry about Bobby. I know you guys were..." "It's done." "Philip, come on, this place is done. It's cooked." Brian looks at him. "What do you mean?" "We're getting out of here." "But I thought..." "Take a look." Philip indicates the growing number of shadows out on Greenbrier Lane. "We're drawing them like flies on shit." "Yeah, but the barricades are still..." "The longer we stay here, Brian, the more it's gonna get like a prison." Philip stares out the window. "Gotta keep moving forward." "When?" "Soon." "Like tomorrow?" "We'll start packing in the morning. Get as many supplies in the suburban as we can." Silence. Brian looks at his brother. "You okay?" "Yeah." Philip keeps staring. "Go to sleep." At breakfast, Philip decides to tell his daughter that Bobby had to up and go home, to go take care of his folks, and the explanation seems to satisfy the little girl. Later that morning, Nick and Philip dig the grave out back, choosing a soft spot at the end of the garden while Brian keeps Penny occupied in the house. Brian thinks they should tell Penny some version of what happened, but Philip tells Brian to stay the hell out of it and keep his mouth shut. Now, in front of the rose trellis in the backyard, Philip and Nick lift the massive, tarp-wrapped body and lower it into the hollowed-out earth. It takes them quite a while to get the hole filled back up, each man tossing spade after spade of rich black Georgia topsoil on their friend. While they work, the atonal moaning of the undead drifts on the wind. It's another blustery, overcast day, and the sounds of the zombie horde carry up across the sky and over the tops of houses. It drives Philip nuts as he sweats in his denims, heaving dirt on the grave. The oily, black, rotten meat odor is as strong as ever. It makes Philip's stomach clench as he puts the last few shovelfuls of earth on the grave. Now Philip and Nick pause on opposite sides of the huge mound, leaning on their shovels, their sweat cooling on their necks. Neither says a word for a long moment, each man lost in his thoughts. Finally, Nick looks up and very softly, very wearily and with great deference says, "You want to say something?" Philip looks across the grave at his buddy. The moaning noises are coming from all directions like the roar of locusts, so loud Philip can barely think straight. Right then, for some strange reason, Philip Blake remembers the night that the three friends got drunk and sneaked into the Starlighter Drive-In Theater out on Waverly Road and broke into the projection booth. Waving his fat little fingers in front of the projector, Bobby had made shadow puppets appear on the distant screen. Philip had laughed so hard that night he thought he was going to puke, watching the silhouettes of rabbits and ducks cavorting across the flickering images of Chuck Norris spin-kicking Nazis. "Some folks thought Bobby Marsh was a simpleton," Philip says with his head lowered, his gaze downturned. "They didn't know the man. He was loyal and he was funny. He was a goddamn good friend. And he died like a man." Nick is looking down, his shoulders trembling slightly, his voice breaking, his words barely audible over the rising clamor around them. "Almighty God, in your mercy turn the darkness of death into the dawn of new life, and the sorrow of pardon into the joy of heaven." Philip feels tears welling up and he grits his teeth so hard his jaw throbs. "Through our Savior Jesus Christ," Nick says in a shaky voice, "who died, rose again, and lives forevermore. Amen. Amen," Philip manages in a faint croak that sounds almost alien to his own ears. The relentless din of the undead swells and surges louder and louder. "Shut the fuck up!" Philip Blake bellows at the zombies, the noises coming from all directions now. "You dead motherfuckers!" Philip turns away from the grave, slowly pivoting. "I will skull fuck every one of you cannibal cocksuckers! I will rip every stinking head off every fucking one of you and shit down your rotten fucking necks!" Hearing this, Nick starts sobbing as Philip runs out of gas and falls to his knees. While Nick cries, Philip just stares down at the fresh dirt as though some answer lies there. If there was ever any doubt about who was in charge, not that there ever was, it is now made abundantly clear that Philip is the Alpha and Omega. They spend the rest of that day packing, Philip issuing orders in monosyllables, his voice low and gravelly with stress. "Take the toolbox," he grunts. "Batteries for the flashlights," he mumbles. "And that box of shells," he mutters. "Extra blankets, too." Nick thinks that maybe they should consider taking two cars. Although most of the abandoned vehicles in the community are ripe for the picking, many of them late-model luxury jobs, many with the keys still in them, Brian worries about splitting the ragged little group into two. Or maybe he's just clinging to his brother now. Maybe Brian just needs to stay close to the center of gravity. They decide to stick with the Chevy Suburban. The thing is a tank, which is exactly what they'll need to get into Atlanta. His stubborn cold now settling into his lungs, causing a perpetual wheeze that may or may not be early-stage pneumonia, Brian Blake focuses on the task at hand. He packs 3 large coolers with food stamped with the furthest expiration dates. Smoked lunch meats, hard cheeses, sealed containers of juice and yogurt and soda and mayonnaise. He fills a cardboard box with bread and beef jerky and instant coffee and bottled water and protein bars and vitamins and paper plates and plastic utensils. He decides to throw an array of chef's knives, cleavers, serrated knives, and boning knives, for whatever close encounters they might stumble into. Brian fills another box with toilet paper and soap and towels and rags. He rifles through the medicine cabinets and takes cold remedies and sleeping pills and pain relievers. And while he's doing this, he gets an idea. Something they should do before they depart. In the basement, Brian finds a small can half full of Benjamin Moore Apple Peel Red and a 2-inch horsehair paintbrush. He finds an old 3-by-3-foot square piece of plywood, and quickly but carefully, he writes a message. 5 simple words in big capital letters, large enough to be seen from a passing vehicle. He nails a couple of short legs on the bottom edge of the sign. Then he takes the sign upstairs and shows it to his brother. "I think we should leave this outside the gate," Brian says to Philip. Philip just shrugs and tells Brian it's up to him. Whatever he wants to do. They wait until after dark to make their exit. At the stroke of 7 p.m., with the cold metallic sun drooping behind the rooftops, they hurriedly pack the Suburban. Working quickly in the lengthening shadows, while monsters swarm against the barricade, they form a sort of bucket brigade, quickly passing suitcases and containers from the side door of the house to the open hatch of the SUV. They take their original axes with an assortment of additional picks and shovels and hatchets and saws and cutting blades from the tool shed out back. They bring rope and wire and road flares and extra coats and snow boots and fire starter blocks. They also pack a siphoning tube and as many extra plastic tanks of gasoline as can fit into the rear storage well. The Suburban's tank is currently full. Philip managed to siphon 15 gallons worth earlier in the day from an abandoned sedan in a neighbor's garage, as they have no clue about the status of local gas stations. Over the last 4 days, Philip has discovered a variety of sporting guns in neighboring homes. Rich folks love their duck season in these parts. They love picking off green heads from the luxury of their heated blinds with their high-powered rifles and purebred hounds. Philip's old man used to do it the hard way, with nothing but waiter's moonshine and a mean disposition. Now, Philip chooses 3 guns to stow in vinyl zip-up bags in the rear compartment. One is a .22 caliber Winchester rimfire, and the other 2 are Marlin Model 55 shotguns. The Marlins are especially useful. They're known as goose guns. Fast and accurate and powerful, the 55s are designed for killing migratory fowl at high altitudes, or in this case, the bullseye of a skull at 100-plus yards. It's almost 8 o'clock by the time they get the Suburban packed and get Penny situated in the middle seat. Bundled in a down coat with her stuffed penguin at her side, she seems oddly sanguine, her pale face drawn and languid, as though she were about to visit the pediatrician. Doors click open and shut. Philip climbs behind the wheel. Nick takes the front passenger seat and Brian settles in next to Penny in the middle. The sign sits on the floor, pressed against Brian's knees. The ignition fires. The growl of the engine carries across the still darkness, making the undead stir on the other side of the barricade. "Let's do this quick, y'all," Philip says under his breath, slamming it into reverse. "Hold on." Philip puts the pedal to the floor and the 4-wheel drive digs in. The gravitational force throws everyone forward as the Suburban roars backward. In the rearview mirror, the weak spot in the makeshift barricade looms closer and closer until, bang, the vehicle bursts through the cedar planking and into the dim streetlight of Greenbrier Lane. Immediately, the left rear quarter panel collides with a walking corpse as Philip stands on the brakes and jacks it into drive. The zombie launches 20 feet into the air behind them, doing a limp pirouette in a mist of blood,
a piece of its moldering arm detaching and pinwheeling in the opposite direction. The Suburban blasts off toward the main conduit, smashing through three more zombies, sending them flying off into oblivion. With each impact, the dull thumping sensations traveling through the chassis, as well as the yellowish bug-like smears left on the windshield, make Penny cringe and close her eyes. At the end of the street, Philip yanks the wheel and screeches around the corner, then pushes north toward the entrance. A few minutes later, Philip barks another order. "Okay, do it quick, and I mean quick!" He slams down on the brakes, making everybody lurch forward in their seats again. They've just reached the great entrance gate, visible in a cone of streetlight across a short expanse of shrub-lined gravel. "This'll just take a second," Brian says, grabbing his sign, clicking his door handle. "Leave it running. Just get it done." Brian slips out of the car, carrying the big 3x3 sign. In the cold night air, he hastens across the gravel threshold, his ears hyper-alert and sensitive to the distant thrum of groaning noises. They're coming this way. Brian chooses a spot just to the right of the entrance gate, a section of brick wall unobstructed by shrubbery, and he positions the sign against the wall. He sinks the wooden legs into the soft earth to stabilize the board, and then hurries back to the car, satisfied he's done his part for humanity, or whatever's left of it. As they drive off, each and every one of them, even Penny, glances back through the rear window at the little square sign receding into the distance behind them. All dead. Do not enter. Chapter 5. They head west, slowly, through the rural darkness, keeping their speed down around 30 miles per hour. The four lanes of Interstate 20 are littered with abandoned cars, as the macadam snakes toward the sickly pink glow of the western horizon, where the city awakes like a bruise of light on the night sky. They're forced to weave through the obstacle course of wrecks with agonizing slowness, but they manage to put nearly 5 miles behind them before things start going wrong. For most of these 5 miles, Philip keeps thinking of Bobby and all the things they could have done to save him. The pain and regret are burrowing deep down in the pit of Philip's gut. A cancer metastasizing into something darker and more poisonous than grief. In order to fight the emotions, he keeps thinking of that old trucker's adage, "Scan, don't stare." Gripping the wheel with the practiced clench of a longtime hauler, he sits forward in his seat, his gaze alert and fixed on the margins of the highway. For 5 miles, only a handful of dead brush the ghostly edges of their headlights. Just outside of Conyers, they pass a couple stragglers shuffling along the shoulder of the road like blood-splattered AWOL soldiers. Passing the Stonecrest Mall, they see a cluster of dark figures hunkered down in a ditch, apparently feasting on some sort of roadkill, either animal or human. Impossible to tell in the flickering darkness. But that's been the extent of it, for 5 miles at least, and Philip keeps his speed at a steady but safe 30 miles per hour. Any slower and they risk hooking a stray monster. Any faster, and they risk sideswiping the growing number of wrecks and abandoned vehicles cluttering the lanes. The radio is dead, and the others ride in silence, their gazes glued to the passing landscape. The outer rings of Metro Atlanta roll past them in slow motion, a series of pine forests broken by an occasional bedroom community or strip mall. They pass car dealerships as dark as morgues, the endless ocean of new models like coffins reflecting the milky moonlight. They pass deserted Waffle Houses, their windows busted out like open sores, and office parks as barren as war zones. They pass Shoney's and trailer parks and Kmart's and RV centers, each one more desolate and ruined than the last. Small fires burn here and there. Parking lots look like the dark playrooms of mad children, the abandoned cars strewn across the pavement like toys thrown in anger. Broken glass glitters everywhere. In less than a week and a half, the plague has apparently savaged the outer exurbs of Atlanta. Here,
in the rural nature preserves and office campuses, where middle-class families have emigrated over the years to escape the arduous commutes, back-breaking mortgages, and high-stress urban life, the epidemic has laid waste to the social order in a matter of days. And for some reason, it's the sight of all the devastated churches that bothers Philip the most. Each sanctuary they pass is in a progressively worse state. The New Birth Missionary Baptist Center outside of Harmon is still smoldering from a recent fire, its charred ruin of a cross rising against the heavens. A mile and a half down the road, the Luther Rice Seminary features hastily hand-scrawled signs over its portals, warning passers-by that the end is nigh and the rapture is here, and all you sinners can kiss your asses goodbye. The Unity Faith Christian Cathedral looks as though it's been ransacked and scoured clean and then pissed upon. The parking lot at the St. John the Revelator Pentecostal Palace resembles a battlefield littered with bodies, many of the corpses still moving with the telltale somnambulant hunger of the undead. What kind of God would let this happen? And while we're on the subject, what kind of God would let a simple, innocent, good old boy like Bobby Marsh die in such a way? What kind of... Oh, shit! The voice comes from the back seat, and it shakes Philip out of his dark musings. What? Look, Brian says, his voice weak from either his cold or the fear, or maybe a little of both. Philip glances at the rearview mirror, and he sees his brother's anxious expression in the green glow of the dash. Brian is pointing toward the western horizon. Philip gazes back through the windshield, instinctively pumping the brakes. What? I don't see anything. Holy crap, Nick says from the passenger seat. He's staring through a break in the piney woods off to the right, where light shines through the trees. About 500 yards ahead of them, the highway banks off in a northwesterly direction, cutting through a stand of pines. Beyond the trees, through clearings in the foliage, flames are visible. The interstate is on fire. God damn it, Philip says on a tense sigh. He slows the vehicle to a crawl as they make the turn. Within moments, the overturned tanker truck comes into view, lying jackknifed in a cocoon of flames like an upended dinosaur. The truck's carcass blocks the two westbound lanes, its cab detached and lying in pieces, tangled with three other cars across the median and both of the eastbound lanes. The scorched shells of other cars lie overturned behind the burning wreckage. Beyond the wreck, the lanes look like a parking lot, with scores of cars, some burning, most of them tangled in the chain reaction. Philip pulls the Suburban over and brings it to a stop on the shoulder 50 yards from the dwindling flames. That's just fantastic, he says to no one in particular, wanting to launch a barrage of profanity, but barely containing himself on account of Penny's ears being inches away. From this distance, even in the flickering darkness, several things are clear. First and foremost, it's obvious they are either going to have to find a team of firefighters and heavy-duty towing equipment in order to continue on course, or they're going to have to figure out a fucking detour. Second, it looks as though whatever happened here took place in the very recent past, perhaps earlier today, perhaps only hours ago. The pavement around the wreck is blackened and scarred, as though a meteor had punched a hole in it, and even the trees lining the highway are charred from the shockwaves. Even through the closed windows of the Suburban, Philip can smell the acrid stench of burning diesel and melted rubber. What now? Brian finally says. Gotta turn around, Nick says, looking over his shoulder. Just let me think for a second, Philip says, staring at the overturned truck cab, the roof sheared off it like the lid of a tin can. In the darkness, charred bodies lie sprawled across the muddy median. Some of them are twitching with the lazy undulations of snakes waking up. Come on, Philip, we can't get around it, Nick says. Brian speaks up. Maybe we can cut across 278. God damn it, shut up and let me think! The sudden flare of rage makes Philip's skull throb with the force of a splitting migraine, and he grits his teeth. clenching his fists and stuffing the voice back down inside himself. Crack it open. Do it. Tear it open now. Tear the heart out. Sorry, Philip says, wiping his mouth, glancing over his shoulder at the frightened little girl huddling in the darkness of the back seat. I'm real sorry, Pumpkin. Daddy lost it there for a second. The little girl stares at the floor. What do you want to do? Brian asked softly, and from the forlorn tone of his voice, it sounds as though he would follow his brother into the flames of hell if Philip thought that was the best option right now. Last exit was what, maybe a mile or so back there? Philip glances over his shoulder. I'm thinking that maybe we could... The slapping noise comes out of nowhere, cutting Philip off mid-thought. Penny shrieks. Shit! Nick jerks away from the passenger window where a charred corpse has materialized out of the darkness. Get down, Nick, now. Philip's voice is flat and unaffected, like a radio dispatcher, as he quickly leans over to the glove box, pops the tiny door, and fishes for something. The thing outside the window presses up against the glass, barely recognizable as human, its flesh blistered to a crisp. Brian, cover Penny's eyes. Shit! Shit! Nick ducks down and covers his head as though in an air raid. Shit! 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 Philip finds the Ruger 22 pistol where he left it, already with a round in the chamber. In one fluid motion, Philip raises the weapon with his right hand, while simultaneously jacking down the power window with his left. The burned zombie reaches through the opening with its scorched, emaciated arm, letting out a guttural moan, but before it could grab hold of Nick's shirt, Philip squeezes off a single shot, point blank into the thing's skull. The bark of the Ruger is enormously loud inside the Suburban's interior, and it makes everybody jump as the charred corpse whiplashes, a direct hit above its left temple sending brain matter spitting across the inside of the windshield. The thing slides down the outside of the passenger door, the muffled sound of its body hitting the pavement barely audible over the ringing in Philip's ears. 22 caliber semi-autos like the Ruger have a unique bark. The blast sounds like a hard, flat slap, a 2x4 smacking concrete, and the gun invariably jumps in the shooter's hand. That night, despite the muffling effect of the interior of the Suburban, that single boom echoed out across the dark landscape, reverberating over treetops and office parks, carrying on the wind. The slapback could be heard a mile away, piercing the silence of the deep woods, penetrating the mortified auditory canals of shadowy creatures, awakening dead central nervous systems. Everybody all right? Philip looks around the dark interior, setting the hot gun down on the carpeted hump next to him. Everybody cool? Nick is just now rising back up, his eyes wide and hot, taking in all the residue on the inside of the glass. Penny, curled up in Brian's arms, keeps her eyes shut, as Brian frantically looks around, peering through all the windows looking for any other intruders. Philip slams the Suburban into reverse, kicking the accelerator as he quickly rolls the window back up. Everybody jerks forward as the vehicle screeches backward, 100 feet, 150 feet, 200 feet, away from the smoking tanker truck. Then the Suburban skids to a stop, and they sit there in a stunned silence for a moment. Nothing moves outside in the flickering shadows. Nobody says anything for the longest time. But Philip is convinced he's not the only one at this moment, wondering if this 20-mile trek into the city is going to be a lot harder than they originally thought. They sit there in the idling Suburban for quite some time, debating their best course of action, and this makes Philip very antsy. He doesn't like sitting in one place for very long, especially with the engine running, burning gas and time, with those moving shadows behind the burning trees. But the group can't seem to come to a consensus, and Philip is trying his hardest to be a benevolent dictator in this little banana republic. Look, I still say we try to drive around it. Philip gives a nod toward the darkness to the south. The far shoulder of the oncoming lanes is littered with smoldering vehicles, but there's a narrow gap, maybe the width of the Suburban with a few inches to spare, between the gravel shoulder and the thicket of pines along the highway. The recent rains, combined with the oil spill from the overturned tanker, have turned the land to slop. But the Suburban is a big, heavy vehicle with wide tires, and Philip's driven this thing through far worse conditions.
"It's too steep, Philly," Nick says, wiping the gray matter from the inside of the windshield with a grimy towel.
"Yeah, man, I have to agree," Brian says from the shadows of the back seat, his arm around Penny, the anguished features of his face visible in the flicker of firelight.
"I vote for heading back to the last exit."
"We don't know what we'll find on 278, though. It could be worse."
"We don't know that," Nick says.
"We gotta keep moving forward."
"But what if it's worse in the city? Seems like it's getting worse the closer we get."
"We're still 15, 20 miles away. We don't know shit about what it's like in Atlanta."
"I don't know, Philly."
"Tell you what," Philip says. "Let me take a look."
"What do you mean?"
He reaches for the gun.
"I'll just take a quick look."
"Wait!" Brian speaks up.
"Philip, come on, we gotta stick together."
"I'm just gonna see what the ground is like, see if we can make it through."
"Daddy?"
Penny starts to say something, and then thinks better of it.
"It's okay, Punkin. I'll be right back."
Brian looks out the window unconvinced.
"We agreed we'd stick together, no matter what."
"Come on, man."
"It'll take 2 minutes." Philip opens his door, shoving the Ruger into his belt. The cool air and the sound of crackling flames and the smell of ozone and burning rubber waft into the Suburban like uninvited guests.
"You gotta sit tight. I'll be right back."
Philip climbs out of the car. The door slams. Brian sits in the silent Suburban for a moment, listening to his heart thudding in his chest. Nick is looking through each and every window, scanning the immediate vicinity, which is alive with flickering shadows. Penny gets very still. Brian looks at the little girl. The child looks like she's shrinking into herself, like a little night bloom, contracting into itself, pulling its petals shut.
"He'll be right back, kiddo," Brian says to the kid.
He aches for her. This isn't right. A child going through this. But on some level, Brian knows how she feels.
"He's a tough old boy, Philip. He can beat the crap out of any monster comes along, believe me."
From the front seat, Nick turns and says,
"Listen to your uncle, sweetie, he's right. Your daddy can take care of himself and then some."
"I saw your daddy catch a rabid dog once," Brian says.
"He was maybe 19, and there was this German shepherd terrorizing the neighbor kids."
"I remember that," Nick says.
"Your daddy chased that thing, foaming mouth and all, down to the dry creek bed, and he wrestled the damn thing into a trash barrel."
"I totally remember that," Nick says.
"Grabbed it with his bare hands, threw it halfway across the gully before slamming the trash can down on it like he was catching a fly."
Brian reaches down and tenderly brushes a strand of hair from the little girl's face.
"He'll be okay, honey. Trust me. He's a mean muchacho."
Outside the vehicle, a piece of burning wreckage falls to the ground. The clatter makes everybody jump. Nick looks at Brian.
"Hey, man. You mind reaching back into that zipper bag by the wheel well?"
Brian looks at Nick.
"What do you need?"
"One of them goose guns."
Brian stares at him a moment, then turns and leans over the back headrest. He roots out the long canvas hunting bag wedged between a cooler and a backpack. He unzips it and finds one of the Marlin 55s. Handing the shotgun across the back seat to Nick in the front, Brian says,
"You need the shells, too?"
"I think it's already loaded," Nick says,
hinging open the barrel and peering down into the breech. Brian can tell Nick is handy with the thing, has probably hunted before, although Brian never witnessed it. Brian had never been the type to participate in the manly pursuits of his younger brother and his cronies, although he secretly yearned to do just that.
"Two shells in the breech," Nick says,
snapping the barrel shut.
"Just be careful with that thing," Brian says.
"Used to hunt feral hogs with one of these babies," Nick says,
cocking and locking it.
"Hogs?"
"Yep, wild hogs. Up to Chattahoochee Reservation. Used to go on night hunts with my dad and my Uncle Vern.
Pigs you're talking about, Brian says incredulously.
Yeah, basically. A hog is just a big old pig. Maybe the older two, I'm not...
Another loud metallic crash comes from outside Nick's window. Nick jerks the barrel towards the noise, finger on the trigger, his teeth gnashing with nervous tension. Nothing moves outside the passenger window. Muscles uncoil inside the Suburban. A long sigh of relief from Nick. Brian starts to say,
"We gotta get our butts in gear before..."
Another noise. This time it comes from the driver's side, a shuffling of feet. And before Nick can even register the identity of the shadowy figure approaching the Suburban's driver's side window, he swings the Marlin's muzzle up at the window, takes aim, and is about to squeeze off a couple of 20-gauge greetings when a familiar voice booms outside the car.
"Jesus Christ!"
Philip is visible outside the window just for an instant before ducking out of the line of fire.
"Oh God, I'm sorry. I'm sorry,"
Nick says, instantly recognizing his mistake. Philip's voice outside the window is lower now, more controlled, but still seething with anger.
"You won't point that thing away from the goddamn window."
Nick lowers the barrel.
"I'm sorry, Philip, my bad. I'm sorry."
The door clicks, and Philip slips back into the car, breathing hard, his face shiny with sweat. He shuts his door and lets out a long breath.
"Nick, Philip, I'm sorry. I'm a little jumpy."
For a moment, Philip looks like he's going to take the other man's head off. Then the anger fades.
"We're all a little jumpy, I get that. I'm totally sorry. Just pay attention."
"I will, I will."
Brian speaks up.
"What'd you find out there?"
Philip reaches up to the stick shift.
"A way around this damn mess."
He flips it into four-wheel drive and slams the lever down.
"Everybody hold on."
He turns the wheel, and they slowly roll across a spray of broken glass. The shards crunch under the Suburban's massive wheels, and nobody says anything, but Brian's thinking about the potential for flat tires. Philip steers the vehicle down across the center median, which is a shallow culvert overgrown with switchgrass, weeds, and cattails, and the rear wheels dig into the rutted earth. As they approach the other side, Philip gives it a little more juice, and the Suburban lurches upward and across the eastbound lanes. Philip keeps his hands glued to the steering wheel as they approach the far shoulder.
"Hold on,"
he calls out, as they suddenly plunge down a slope of muddy weeds. The Suburban pitches sideways like a sinking ship. Brian holds on to Penny, and Nick holds on to the center armrest. Yanking the wheel, Philip kicks the accelerator. The vehicle fishtails toward a narrow gap in the wreckage. Tree branches scrape the side of the SUV. The rear wheels slide sideways, then chew into the mud. Philip wrestles the wheel. Everybody else holds their respective breaths as the Suburban scrapes through the opening. When the car emerges out the other side, a spontaneous cheer rings out. Nick slaps Philip on the back, and Brian whoops and hollers triumphantly. Even Penny seems to lighten up a little, the hint of a smile tugging at the corners of her tulip-shaped lips. Through the windshield, they can see the tangle of vehicles in the darkness ahead of them. At least 20 cars, SUVs, and light trucks in the westbound lanes, most of them damaged in the pileup. All of them abandoned, many of them burned out shells. The empty vehicles stretch back at least 100 yards. Philip puts the pedal to the metal, muscling the SUV back toward the road. He jerks the wheel. The rear of the SUV wags and churns. Something's wrong. Brian feels the loss of traction beneath him like a buzzing in his spine, the engine revving suddenly. The cheering dies. The car is stuck. For a moment, Philip keeps the pedal to the floor, urging the thing forward with his ass cheeks, as if his sheer force of will and white-hot rage and the tightening of his sphincter muscles can get the blasted thing to move. But the Suburban keeps drifting sideways. Soon, the thing is simply spinning all four wheels, kicking up twin gushers of mud out the back into the moonlit darkness behind them.
Fuck! 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 Fuck!
Philip slams a fist down on the steering wheel, hard enough to make the thing crack and send a splinter of pain up his arm. He practically shoves the foot feed through the floor, the engine screaming.
Let up on him, man, Nick hollers over the noise. It's just digging us in deeper.
Fuck! Philip lets up on the gas. The engine winds down, the Suburban leaning to one side, a foundering boat in brackish waters.
We gotta push it out, Brian says after a moment of tense silence.
Take the wheel, Philip says to Nick, opening his door and slipping outside. Give it gas when I tell you to. Come on, Brian.
Brian opens the rear door, slips outside, and joins his brother in the glow of the taillights. The rear tires have sunk at least 6 inches into the greasy muck, each rear quarter panel spattered with mud. The front wheels are no better. Philip places his big, gnarled hands on the wood grain of the tailgate, and Brian moves to the other side, assuming a wide stance in order to get a better purchase in the mud. Neither of them notices the dark figures lumbering out of the trees on the other side of the highways.
Okay, Nick, now!
Philip calls out and shoves with all his might. The engine growls. The wheels churn, spewing fountains of mud as the Blake brothers push and push. They push with everything they have, all to no avail. As the slow-moving figures behind them shamble closer.
Again!
Philip shouts, putting all his weight behind the shoving. The rear wheels spin, sinking deeper into the mire, as Brian gets sprayed with an aerosol of mud. Behind him, moving through a fog bank of smoke and shadows, the uninvited close the distance to about 50 yards, crunching through broken glass with the slow, lazy, awkward movements of injured lizards.
Get back in the car, Brian.
Philip's voice is abruptly changed, becoming low and even.
Right now.
What is it?
Just do it.
Philip is opening the rear hatch. Hinges squeak as he reaches in and fishes for something.
Don't ask any questions.
But what about...
Brian's words stick in his throat as he catches a glimpse in his peripheral vision of at least a dozen dark